A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been unpacking into Euroboxes during a move, and it made him notice something most of us miss. He wrote to us about it, and I'm going to read what he sent because the whole thing is worth hearing. He says, "The shipping container has become something of a celebrity in the logistics world. There are books about it, documentaries about it, and it's widely recognized as one of the inventions that quietly transformed the global economy. What I hadn't appreciated until recently is that standardization didn't stop with the shipping container itself. Once you've standardized a 20-foot or 40-foot container, you've only solved part of the problem. Those containers still need to be filled efficiently. The pallets inside them need standard dimensions. The containers that sit on those pallets need standard dimensions. Even the smallest storage bins in a warehouse benefit from fitting into the same modular system. Standardization doesn't end with the container. It cascades all the way down." He goes on, "That realization only hit me because I've been unpacking in the Euroboxes and attached lid containers during our move. These things are phenomenal. I was loading them with books, stacking them 4 and 5 high, and they barely noticed. They're designed around standardized footprints, so everything fits together almost like giant industrial Lego. It also made me think back to our earlier conversation about Dolavi. I hadn't realized that Israel was an early player in this world. Companies like Dolavi recognized that if logistics was becoming standardized internationally, there would be enormous demand for standardized industrial plastic containers as well." Then he asked the core questions. "I'd love to hear the history of that less famous story. We all know about the shipping container, but when did industry decide that the subunits should also become standardized? How did we arrive at the Eurobox, the attached lid container, the pallet box, and all the other modular building blocks that make modern warehouses work? Was this driven by Germany, by European standards bodies, or by logistics companies themselves? It also strikes me that we're now far enough into the story to judge whether the idea actually worked. These industrial HDPE containers have been in demand in commercial use for decades, and many of them are apparently still in circulation. That seems like a remarkable proof of concept. So why does this whole ecosystem remain almost invisible outside warehouses? The shipping container became famous. The standardized building blocks inside it, the parts that most of us are actually more likely to handle, seem to have remained one of industry's best-kept secrets. So we're going inside the box today, literally. Tracing the standardization story that nobody wrote a book about, and we'll end with a durability proof point that will change how you see every gray plastic crate you encounter for the rest of your life."
The thing that jumps out at me from Daniel's questions is the word cascade. He's exactly right, and the cascade has a starting point that most people get backwards. The shipping container didn't create the pallet standard. The pallet standard came first.
Say that again.
1961. The International Union of Railways, the UIC, established the Euro pallet at 800 by 1200 millimeters. That's a rail standard, not a shipping standard. European railways needed interchangeable loading across different national networks, and they needed a pallet that could be forklifted from a German boxcar onto a French one without anyone repacking anything. The container standard as we know it, the ISO 668 series, wasn't finalized until the late 1960s.
So the pallet predates the container by nearly a decade.
And here's where it gets elegant. When the ISO container standard settled on a width of 2,400 millimeters internally, two Euro pallets, each 1,200 millimeters wide, fit side by side with almost no wasted space. 2 times 1,200 is 2,400. That alignment wasn't planned. The rail people and the shipping people were solving different problems. But the math worked out so perfectly that the two standards locked together like they'd been designed as a system.
Convergent evolution in industrial standards. That's not something you hear every day.
It's the kind of accident that only happens when multiple industries are all being forced toward the same physical constraints. A rail car, a truck bed, a shipping container. They all have width limits set by infrastructure. tunnels, road lanes, crane spans. The constraints converge, so the solutions converge.
So the container created the outer boundary, but the inner logic was already there waiting for it.
And once you've got a pallet standard, the next question is unavoidable. What goes on the pallet? If your pallet is 800 by 1200, you want boxes that tile across that surface without gaps. Gaps mean wasted space, and wasted space in logistics is wasted money. It's fuel, it's warehouse square footage, it's an extra truck you didn't need to run.
And this is where the Eurobox comes in.
600 by 400 millimeters. That's the footprint. Four of them fill a Euro pallet layer exactly. Two across the 1200 millimeter dimension, two across the 800. 600 plus 600 is 1200. 400 plus 400 is 800. It's arithmetic. A warehouse worker can do in their head at 3 in the morning.
And the height stacks cleanly too, right?
Standard Euroboxes come in heights that are multiples of a base module. So 8 layers of the standard 300 millimeter tall box gives you a pallet load just under 2.4 meters, which is the internal height of a standard container door opening. The whole thing is a three-dimensional grid. Width, depth, height, all of it derived from the container or from the pallet that happened to fit the container.
So, who actually sat down and said, 600 by 400, that's the number?
The German automotive industry. The VDA, Verband der Automobil Industrie, codified this in the 1980s as VDA 4500. They needed standardized returnable containers for just-in-time parts delivery. Think about an auto assembly line, thousands of suppliers shipping components to one plant, all on tight schedules. If every supplier uses different box sizes, the logistics team spends half their time playing Tetris with mismatched crates. Standardize the box, and suddenly every truck, every pallet, every warehouse rack is operating on the same grid.
So it wasn't some Brussels committee dreaming up a utopian logistics system. It was German car companies trying to not lose money on inefficient parts delivery.
That's the pattern, actually. Standards that stick are almost always driven by a specific industry with a specific pain point. The automotive supply chain in the 1980s was the forcing function. Once the big German automakers told their suppliers, "You'll ship in VDA 4500 containers or we'll find new suppliers," the standard spread through the supply chain like, well, like a standard. Every Tier 1 supplier adopted it, then every Tier 2, and suddenly the entire European automotive logistics ecosystem was speaking the same dimensional language.
And once that ecosystem exists, it leaks out. The box manufacturer who makes VDA containers for BMW is also selling to the food industry, to pharmaceutical distribution, to anyone who moves things on pallets.
The attached lid container is the refinement that makes the system actually work in practice. It's a Eurobox footprint, 600 by 400, but with a hinged lid that locks. You can stack them with the lids open for picking, or closed for shipping. The lids are designed so they don't get lost. They're attached. And the stacking lugs interlock, so a column of 5 loaded containers doesn't shift when a forklift bumps the pallet.
That's the difference between a crate and a system. A crate holds things. A system holds things and also holds the next crate.
The mechanical details are where most standardization efforts fail. It's easy to agree on a footprint. It's hard to agree on the stacking interlock geometry, the lid hinge design, the handle placement, the draft angle for molding. All of that had to be specified and tested and agreed upon by competing manufacturers who, in any other context, would rather eat glass than collaborate with each other.
And they did collaborate.
Through the standards bodies. The VDA drove the initial specification, but then it got picked up by DIN, the German Institute for Standardization, and eventually by CEN, the European Committee for Standardization. The Eurobox became a proper European standard, not just a German automotive quirk. That's the second cascade, from company spec to industry spec to national standard to international standard.
So Daniel's question about who drove this, Germany, European standards bodies, or logistics companies, the answer is all three, in sequence.
Germany provided the initial demand through automotive manufacturing. The standards bodies provided the forum and the process for turning a corporate spec into a public standard. And the logistics companies, the DHLs and DB Schenkers of the world, provided the adoption at scale because once the standard existed, it was in their interest to use it everywhere. a logistics company that can move the same box from a German auto plant to a French warehouse to a Spanish distribution center without repacking at any border, has a massive cost advantage over one that can't.
All right. So the standards were set on paper. But paper standards don't survive 30 years of forklifts. That's where Dolavi enters the story.
Dolav was founded in Israel in 1976. The timing is interesting. International containerization was just maturing, the ISO standards were settled, and the Euro pallet was already 15 years old. The founders looked at this emerging standardized logistics system and asked a question that seems obvious in retrospect. If the container is standard, and the pallet is standard, and the box is standard, shouldn't the heavy-duty industrial container also be standard?
And Israel in 1976 wasn't exactly the obvious place to start a plastics logistics company.
No domestic automotive giant, no massive internal market, no history in industrial plastics manufacturing. But Dolav had an insight that a company from a small country might be uniquely positioned to have. If the system is international, you don't need a domestic market. You need a product that fits the international standard, and then the whole world is your customer. A German company might be tempted to optimize for the German market. An Israeli company has to build for the global standard from day one because there's no local market to fall back on.
That's a constraint that becomes an advantage.
The Dolavov box, the heavy-duty pallet box, is designed for the 1200 by 800 Euro pallet footprint, four-way forklift entry so it can be picked up from any side, stackable 4 or 5 high when fully loaded, and is rotomolded HDPE, high-density polyethylene, in a single piece.
Explain rotomolding for someone who's never seen it done.
Rotational molding. You put polyethylene powder into a mold, heat it, and rotate it slowly in two axes. The powder melts and coats the inside of the mold evenly. What you get is a single-piece hollow structure with uniform wall thickness and no weak points. No seams, no welds, no joints. The corners, which is where injection molded containers always fail, are actually the strongest part of a roto-molded box, because the material pools slightly in the corners during the molding process.
So the manufacturing process is inherently producing the durability at the stress points where you need it most.
And Dolav has the receipts on durability. They've documented boxes still in active commercial use after 30 years. 30 years of forklift tines slamming into them, 30 years of being dropped from loading docks, 30 years of sitting in the sun and the rain and the freezing cold, 30 years of chemical exposure depending on what's being shipped.
30 years.
That's longer than most trucks stay on the road, longer than most warehouse racking systems last. The box outlives the infrastructure around it.
So the upfront cost, which I assume is higher than cardboard or wood, becomes almost irrelevant when you amortize it over 3 decades.
Let's do rough numbers. A heavy-duty Dolavi-style pallet box might cost, say, $150 to $200. I'm not quoting their pricing, just a ballpark for this class of product. A cardboard Gaylord box with the same application might cost $15, but the cardboard box lasts one trip, maybe two if you're gentle. The HDPE box lasts thousands of trips over 30 years. The cost per use drops to fractions of a cent. That's not even counting the avoided cost of box failure. The product damage, the cleanup, the worker injury risk when a soggy cardboard bottom gives out?
Buy once, cry once, at industrial scale.
The economics get even better when you factor in the standardization. A Dolavi box that fits the Euro pallet perfectly means you're using every cubic centimeter of container space. If standardization pushes container utilization from 65% to 90%, and that's roughly the magnitude we're talking about, the savings in shipping costs alone dwarf the cost of the boxes.
That's the counterfactual Daniel was hinting at. What if subunit standardization had failed?
The container would still work. You can stuff a container with mismatched boxes and barrels and odd-shaped crates. Ships would still cross oceans, but loading efficiency would have stayed in the 60 to 70% range. You'd need more containers to move the same amount of goods, more ships, more fuel, more port time. Containerization might have remained economical for bulk commodities, but not for the kind of mixed consumer goods that now fill container ships. The cascade from container to pallet to box is what made the container revolution actually revolutionary rather than just incrementally better.
The invisible boxes inside the famous box are doing a disproportionate share of the economic work.
That brings us to Daniel's last question, which might be the most interesting one. Why is this whole ecosystem invisible? The shipping container got the book deal. Mark Levinson wrote The Box, and it became the definitive story of how a metal rectangle transformed global trade. There are documentaries, museum exhibits, entire college courses built around the container. But the Eurobox? The attached lid container? The Dulavi pallet box? Nobody, outside logistics, has heard of them.
I think part of it's that the container is a symbol, and the Eurobox is a tool. A container ship is visually spectacular. 20,000 metal boxes stacked 100 feet high, cranes the size of office buildings. It photographs well. A gray plastic crate doesn't photograph well.
The container also has a clean origin story. Malcolm McLean, the trucking entrepreneur, loads 58 containers onto a converted tanker in 1956, and the world changes. One guy, one idea, one moment. The Eurobox doesn't have that. It emerged incrementally from committees and standards, bodies, and automotive supply chain requirements over 2 decades. There's no single hero, no dramatic launch, no photograph that captures the moment.
The other thing is that consumers actually see shipping containers. They're stacked at ports visible from highways. They're repurposed as pop-up shops and swimming pools and housing. You can buy a used shipping container on Craigslist. But the Eurobox lives entirely inside the B2B world. The only time a consumer encounters one is at a warehouse club, and even then they're seeing the product on the pallet, not the system that got it there.
The invisibility is almost a feature of good infrastructure. The best infrastructure is the kind you never notice. You don't think about the water pipes under your street until one bursts. You don't think about the power grid until the lights go out. The Eurobox system is infrastructure that hasn't burst. It just works, silently, for decades, in warehouses you'll never visit.
There's also something almost unglamorous about plastic. Steel containers have a kind of industrial romance. Plastic crates feel disposable, even when they're demonstrably more durable than the steel box they ride inside.
That's the irony. A shipping container has a service life of maybe 15 to 20 years in active marine use before corrosion and fatigue catch up with it. The plastic box inside it can go 30 years and still be structurally sound. The disposable-looking thing is the durable thing.
We've got this system that's more durable than the famous thing it rides inside, more economically important than most people realize, and completely invisible to the public. What do we actually do with that knowledge?
Well, here's the practical part. The 600 by 400 Eurobox system is available to consumers. You can buy the exact same attached lid containers that BMW uses for parts delivery. They're not even particularly expensive. You can get a stack of them for what you'd spend on a weekend of takeout, and they'll outlive you.
This is the rare case where the consumer product is literally the industrial product. There's no consumer downgrade, no thinner plastic, no weaker hinges. The box you buy for your garage is the box that spent 10 years in an automotive supply chain before being retired to retail.
The modular arithmetic works in your garage exactly the way it works in a warehouse. 4 Euroboxes fill a shelf that's 1200 by 800. They stack. They interlock. If you're moving house, as Daniel is, you can pack an entire room into a column of these things, and they won't shift, they won't crush, and they'll be exactly as useful for the next move 10 years from now.
The durability lesson extends way beyond plastic boxes. The Dulavi case study is really an argument for evaluating purchases on lifetime cost, rather than sticker price. A 30-year box at $200 is cheaper than a 2-year box at $15. The math isn't complicated. But most purchasing decisions, consumer and industrial, are made on upfront cost because the long-term number is harder to calculate and easier to ignore.
I see this in, well, in everything. Tools, furniture, software. The cheap option is optimized for the moment of purchase. The expensive option is optimized for the decade of use. The Dulavi box is just the most extreme example. The ratio of lifespan to cost is so lopsided that you'd have to be actively bad at arithmetic to choose the disposable alternative.
Unless you're cash constrained in the moment, which is a real constraint. But for a business moving thousands of loads a year, there's no excuse. The amortized cost advantage is so large, it should show up in the quarterly earnings.
The other lesson, and this is the one I think is most useful as a mental model, is about designing interfaces before components. The Eurobox system works because someone defined the interface first, the pallet footprint, the stacking geometry, the modular height increments. Once the interface is fixed, anyone can build components that plug into it. Dolav can build a heavy-duty pallet box. Another company can build an attached lid container. A third can build a folding crate. They all work together because they all respect the same interface.
This is the same logic that made the internet work. Define the protocols, and anyone can build a server or a browser or an app that participates in the network. The EuroPallet is TCP/IP for physical goods.
That's actually not a bad comparison. The shipping container is the physical layer. It moves the bits. The pallet is the packet. The Eurobox is the payload. And the standards bodies are the IETF, arguing about header formats while the world quietly builds on top of their decisions.
Just like internet protocols, the standard outlives the companies that created it. VDA 4500 was driven by German automakers in the 80s. Those specific companies may or may not exist in their current form in 30 years. But the standard will still be there, and boxes built to it will still stack on pallets built to the pallet standard, inside containers built to the container standard.
That longevity is what makes me wonder about the next 30 years. Daniel's prompt is asking us to look at a system that's been working for decades and ask whether it'll keep working. And the open question, the one I don't have a clean answer for, is whether warehouse automation breaks the whole thing.
Say more.
The Eurobox system is optimized for humans with forklifts. A warehouse worker can look at a pallet and see that four Euroboxes fill a layer. A forklift can grab a pallet from any of four sides. The whole system is legible to human operators. But automated warehouses are increasingly using robotic picking systems that don't care about pallet footprints. An autonomous mobile robot might prefer a completely different container geometry, something optimized for robotic grippers rather than human hands and forklift tines.
The question is whether the standard that survived 60 years of technological change, container ships getting bigger, trucks getting more efficient, warehouses getting taller, can survive a shift in the fundamental assumption that a human is moving the box.
The counterargument is that standards are sticky precisely because the installed base is so massive. There are probably hundreds of millions of Euroboxes in circulation. Every warehouse management system knows the 600 by 400 footprint. Every rack is spaced for 1200 millimeter pallets. Replacing all of that would cost trillions. The robots might just have to adapt to the standard rather than the other way around.
Which is what happened with the container itself. Ships got bigger, but they still carry 40-foot containers. The standard held while everything around it changed.
Dolavi boxes from 1996 are still in circulation, which means there are containers moving through warehouses right now that are older than the warehouse workers handling them. That's not just durability, that's a kind of institutional memory embedded in plastic. The box remembers the standard even when the people forget why it exists.
That's the deeper thing Daniel's prompt is pointing at, I think. What other invisible standardization cascades are running the world right now that we haven't noticed? If a gray plastic crate can hide 30 years of engineering and standards negotiation and global supply chain optimization, what else are we walking past every day without seeing?
The electrical grid runs on standards that most electrical engineers couldn't recite from memory. The Internet Protocol Stack. The global container shipping system itself, which most people still think of as boats carrying stuff, rather than as a real-time distributed optimization problem spanning thousands of vessels and hundreds of ports. The most important systems are the ones that have become too boring to notice.
If you take one thing from this episode, it's that the thing you're not looking at is probably doing more work than the thing you are. The shipping container is the celebrity. The Eurobox is the workhorse. And the workhorse will still be doing its job when the celebrity is rusting in a scrapyard.
If you're moving house, buy the Euroboxes. They'll be the last moving boxes you ever buy.
The question that sticks with me, and I don't think we've fully answered it, is whether the next decade of warehouse robotics will reinforce the Eurobox standard, or finally break it. 60 years of compatibility is an incredible run. But automation changes the fundamental assumptions about how things get moved, and standards that can adapt to new fundamentals eventually become the thing they were designed to replace. Friction.
My bet is on the standard surviving. Not because it's perfect, but because it's everywhere. The cost of switching is just too high. But I'll be watching the warehouse automation space with more interest now. If a major player like Amazon starts deviating from Euro footprints in their next generation fulfillment centers, that's the canary.
We should thank Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, as always.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've got a weird prompt about the invisible infrastructure that runs your life, especially something you've touched 100 times but never really seen, send it in. show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.